From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Welcome to The Media Project, WAMC's weekly program on the media. I am not Rex Smith. I'm Judy Patrick. I am the Executive Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association, a new role for me. And I'm here today with Mike Spain. He's the Associate Editor of the Albany Times Union. Kaylin Brown, she's Chair of the Department of Communications at the College of St. Rose in Albany. And Alan Shartok, who has so many titles, but chief of which is he's the head of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Got all that right, Alan?
No, there's a lot more to be said, but okay.
I think he's been a professor, he's run a newspaper.
Political scientist,
too late.
Columnist,
too late.
Observer, commentator, many things, but it's good to be here. I wanted to start by talking about leaks. We had a story this week about the President of the United States telling his leaky staffers they are traitors and cowards. It was his first time calling anyone a traitor since the first week of his presidency when he sailed Chelsea Manning. I wanted to talk about this issue of leaking because many people in the public do think leaks are wrong, but from the news media's perspective, they're very important pieces of how we operate.
And who knows this better than Donald Trump? Because he is a lifelong leaker himself. He leaks over everything he finds. And so the fact is that this guy's a leaker. We know this. We know that he's called news people. He's called before he was a presidential candidate with a phony voice and pretended he was somebody else and did all of that. And we know that while in the White House, he has made telephone calls and leaked himself. So now for him to have the, it's a Yiddish word, the chutzpah to...
Chutzpah, right? Is that it?
The chutzpah to... You got that chin. To call other people traitors as a result of it is extraordinary.
Well, this controversy came to light again because a staffer in the White House, not a high-level staffer, but one of the planners for policy was reportedly saying when it came out that John McCain, the ailing U.S. senator from Arizona, was opposed to Trump's nominee to head the CIA, that it didn't really matter because he'll be, you know, McCain will soon be dying and that opposition will not stand in the way of this appointment. And several people in the room were outraged at that and turned around and called news media and spread it out. And it undermines the efforts by the White House to get this nominee through, although it looks like she will be through now. But it just is another stinging example about how when these leaks come out, it just makes the White House look like chaos.
Well, that, first of all, Michael, that is exactly what he wants. He wants a chaotic, bright, shiny object every moment so that whatever else he's doing, we don't see. But second of all, how do we know? We know that this woman who had made the remark had said, okay, I'll apologize. Somebody there told her not to apologize. Why? Because somebody, the president, is at war with John McCain and has been for years, ever since he said he wasn't a hero during the campaign.
I think all this leaking, though, speaks to the fact that there's not much of an allegiance to the president or to this administration. People are leaking because they're concerned about democracy, and I think that they're talking to the press to make sure that the public is aware of what's going on within the White House, which is chaotic. I agree with you. And I agree that the president seems to thrive on that sort of environment, but it's not advancing any public policy or very little.
But Dr. Brown.
Yes, Dr. Shartok.
Let me.
Oh, we're nothing here.
All right, then.
Yes, I can do surgery on a sentence.
No, but you ascribe a certain motive to the people who are leaking. which is that basically they believe in American democracy. They want people to know what's going on there and the rest of it. I don't believe that for a minute. I have no idea whether it is Trump who's ordering up the leaks himself. We do know that the Washington Post has come up with 3,000 and something lies from Trump. So nobody can believe a word this guy says.
Right. While I agree, Kaylin, that one motivation is to set the record straight and to preserve democracy and make sure that this information is out there and the public knows about these important things. But another motivation for the leaking is for one faction within the White House to undermine another faction and certainly take out retribution against somebody they don't like or expose something they don't want to happen so the public can be in an uproar and then their side can win. So you have a lot of people in the administration who disagree with each other and they're using leaks to get back at each other. And I think that's part of it also. Although I do agree there are people everywhere who are motivated by the right purpose, you know, to defend democracy and to expose bad policy before it gets out there.
So, Michael, extraordinary. And Dr. Brown, Sherry Soda.
I know.
You get it. Okay. All right.
What are we talking
soda?
Latin for? Right.
Well, you know, you got a Katz's Delicatessen and you get a pastrami sandwich and you get a... Dr. Brown's soda. Mm. But I digress.
I'd like a piece of
really?
That.
Really? Judy, bring us back to the point.
No. I want to answer. I want to answer, Mike. We have no idea what narrative is being created there. If you got to work for Donald Trump, you're not a guy who's interested in democracy. What kind of nonsense is that?
Hopeful.
Let's not forget that from a broader perspective how important leaks have been over the course of history for journalism and for the American public. If it wasn't for Daniel Ellsberg, we wouldn't have found out all the important information we needed to know about the Vietnam War.
You are so right, and I hope that everybody will go to WAMC.org and listen to my hour-long conversation with Daniel Ellsberg on that subject.
And I think a lot of people who do leak, they are violating the law. It's true, you're not supposed to leak some of this information. But I have found in the course of my career that government does tend to be secretive and does tend to withhold information that the public does have a right to know. And without leakers, you're not going to know that information.
That's right. It's an important part of the reporting process and the communication process. And the news media relies on people within government to help set the record straight so that when we're hearing the official word, we get the full story and we know the background and we know what contradictory information is out there also. And it's just the way it is, and I don't see it changing. And Trump harping about it does exactly what you said, Alan. It's the shiny object that distracts us from talking about other good topics.
Yeah, and it does tend to continue to demonize the press, calling people who leak to us traitors and cowards, when in fact they're actually being very brave.
Well, not only that, we also know that very good journalists, perhaps Kaylin could speak to this, have gone to jail to protect their sources, and leakers need to be protected. And so that's another aspect of all of this.
They do need to be protected, and most journalists will tell sources who confide information that I will protect you and I am willing to go to jail for this.
And have. They
absolutely have, and will continue to do it. I'm sure there are journalists who would prefer to protect their sources than turn them in. That's one of the only ways, again, what Judy said, is one of the only ways the media get information is via leaks. The alternative is the Freedom of Information Law or the Freedom of Information Act, which takes forever to get filled from a government that's trying to withhold information from the public. So leakers are very important.
In 49 states, the legislatures in 49 states believe this strongly, and they have shield laws to protect reporters and not require them to step forward and reveal their sources when they report.
Okay, news. I'll bite. Who's the 50th?
I think it's Texas. Huh. And the United States government does not have one, although there has been bills in the House and the Senate to do it, and there is a lot of support for it, because even lawmakers who are sometimes burned by the leaks recognize how important it is for a free and open press, and you can't have a repressive situation where you regard someone who reports something unfavorable as being treasonous, like Trump is suggesting.
Moving on, BuzzFeed about a week ago published a video of a former President Barack Obama making some decidedly out of character quips as it was discussed. And that brings to light this whole issue about in the digital world, what can be altered, what can be changed. We always have known that you can put a head photographically, you can put a head of a person to make it look like a mermaid or someone to make it look very thin. But this has always happened. And what can the media do nowadays going forward to help the public understand what's real and what's not? What has been doctored and what has not been doctored?
Well, one of the suggestions, which I don't know if I agree with this, but Nicholas Diakopoulos, who is a professor of communication at Northwestern University, sees this as an opportunity for the traditional media to step in and use their credibility to help lead the public through this, because now you can see somebody on TV saying something and you may be uncertain that that person actually said it. And because of that, we're going to turn to the reliable traditional news media to get the answers. I'm worried that that's not what people will do. They'll be confused and they won't believe anything.
I'm very interested in suggestions that there be forensic algorithms used so that the media can identify who is actually in those videos and who is not. When I was reading about this, I was thinking about the financial investment that's going to be required at colleges and universities who are training journalists at local newspapers. I can't imagine and national outlets as well, but the extraordinary investment that's going to be necessary to get the sort of forensic tools that are necessary to detect what has been manipulated and what has not.
It's almost like you have to run any video through a filter to see if it is fake or if it's real. And that's good if there can be technology that does that. And that would be the news media's responsibility also before they report something. But it also gets into the fuzziness of how you can't believe anything you see on the internet necessarily. So anything can be faked. I mean, it means that the public needs to be more cynical and more careful about what they believe, and they should look at many sources before they draw a conclusion. And I'm not sure that people have the patience to do that, and I'm worried that that a lot of people are, it's going to create a lot more conspiracy theories and just make people not trust anybody.
That's the risk. If you have a well-documented liar like the President of the United States and you have him on tape saying something, you can say, I didn't say that.
That exact thing has happened. He has denied things that he's on tape saying repeatedly.
Yeah, right.
And people will say, well, that's good enough for me.
Now this is a program about the media, so I just want to speak to my constituents out there who are, regular citizens as opposed to you three insiders.
Us four insiders.
Who, me?
You're a media person, Dr. Sharta.
I'm a contrarian. So anyway, I think that people have to recognize that there is nothing that is private anymore. Some journalist is going to get a hold of what you said. You're going to say it, and as your mother must have told you, or maybe your grandmother's now that you're also young, they said, if you don't want to see it in the New York Times, don't say it. And I think a lot of people now have a larger reason for not saying things than they ever did before because of all the intrusive ways in which you guys can, find out what they're saying and splash it in the front pages of your papers.
Well, I think this just warns people to be more skeptical and more aware that if you just see something, it may not be reality, and you should be skeptical. That's all.
I know that the Associated Press at one point, I don't know what they do now, had a very high standard for vetting videos that they accepted or vetting photos. They would actually reach out and talk to the person, did you take this video, to try to verify that this is what it purports to be. But even then, you're relying on someone talking, and you're relying on the veracity of a person out there and whether or not you can dissect it, whether or not someone's trying to con you. That happens in radio once in a while. I used to be a Howard Stern listener, and they would have...
What?
Not anymore. People would call in and con them, and it's very easy to do, especially on live TV or in live radio.
And especially, Judy, since we now all have little phones, where we can do immediate videos ourselves. And there is an edit function on every one of those phones.
So how do you know what's real?
Well, this is a good question. And you just reminded me, Judy, of back years ago, I can remember people submitting both wedding announcements and obituaries to the newspaper that were fake, that were made up. And at the time, several of those had been published because there were not the appropriate filters in place.
And now there's all kinds of verification, and it just means that there's going to have to be deeper, more. I think the Associated Press was ahead of the curve when they were doing this fact-checking to make sure the videos and the photos that they were getting submitted to them were indeed what they purported to be, and it's going to mean that the media has a lot more work ahead of them.
With a lot fewer people.
And a lot fewer people.
And that's the problem. I would ask both of you editors, Mike and Judy, and maybe Professor Brown, who speaks from a higher level. Maybe
I'm the shortest person in the room.
I don't know about that. But anyway.
I would ask you, there was a day that they used to The New York Times used to vet, and I'm sure they still do, every letter that came in, you got a telephone call and said, did you write this letter?
And they do still do that.
Do you do that?
Oh, yeah, we do that at the Times Union.
We used to do that at the Gazette. I'm sure they probably still do.
Right. Very important, right? Because otherwise, you could get sued.
Even beyond being sued, it would be outrageous and wrong and irresponsible to let something go in without verifying that it was indeed that person that submitted the letter.
I guarantee you there are people who do, the newspapers that do not check every letter.
Well, they don't serve the readers well, and they're
at risk.
Well,
if you got one editor, you got a paper, you got one person working there, it's very hard to do it all.
Yep.
So there are a couple of other things that come up with this question of manipulation of images. There's a suggestion that YouTube and Facebook, where many of the human race get their news, could implement this face forensics algorithm and then flag the content on their sites as checked and either problematic or not problematic. So that's valuable. And also there's a conversation being had around this manipulation that maybe this will be the renaissance of mainstream media.
Right. They're saying that maybe we won't trust anyone but the established media that we've long respected.
You know, I say eat your hearts out. That ain't
right,
gonna happen.
Right. I wish that were true. I really wish that were true.
You know, the other issue is that with the declining number of people in the newsroom, we like to talk about crowdsourcing. Oh, we're going to get our news from the people in the field. They're going to phone in
if there's a big storm and you want to know how widespread it is, but it really falls down when it comes to important.
Right, and how do you know that it's true?
You are so suspect here. You all come from established media. Of course you're going to put down, crowdsourcing and people who do this.
It can be very useful sometimes.
But that's the way, Mike, don't you see? That's the way that it's happening now. You know, you guys are fighting a rear guard action, and Judy's saying maybe this is nirvana, maybe they're going to come back and it's all going to change and people are going to respect the printed press. But when you look at the grades that you guys are getting, you know, from the public, it isn't good.
It's still more than members of Congress by far.
And plus, the subscription rates at the New York Times and the Washington Post have escalated in direct proportion to this administration. So more people are looking to reliable sources to get their information.
Yeah, I think the media is pretty good at beating itself up. But when you look at public data or public polling data about all kind of national institutions, the support for banks is down, for religious institutions is down. Public institutions in general, the public has a distrust of them, and
not
journalism
radio,
is part of it. I think public radio was thrown into the journalism category.
No.
Well, that's another question.
We should find that data. We should put a link to it on this web blog we put up on this edition of the Media Project
next
week.
You've got such a big smile on
you.
Let the truth be told.
She was always good at saying, do the work.
The purposes of radio. Or is it a smirk?
You know, moving on, let's talk about the role of public editor. ESPN recently cut its public editor role. I mean, I don't know if there are any public editors left in the country. At one point, newspapers and other media companies thought this was very important, to have someone who was out there as an ombudsman for the public to answer the questions, because they didn't quite trust the leadership at the newspaper or the media company to do this. But you're seeing this being cut. In part, the rationale is that the Twitter universe is going to come forth and social media is going to do the public editor's role.
I think there's some defense for that. First of all, ESPN,
Cutting back,
unquestionably, it is an economic move also. It is expensive to have somebody on staff who's very credible, qualified, long-time professional, who basically their job is to sit there and to vet public comments and to vet stories and criticize the very media that's employing them. And that was an important role at the New York Times after they went through a horrific scandal about 15 years ago, and it helped rebuild their credibility. But they did kind of phase that position out. Margaret Sullivan was the last one. Now she's a media writer for the Washington Post. And it's still a good thing to have, but the public now so easily with social media can criticize and comment and provide alternate opinions for the news media, like the New York Times and the big players and the smaller players, too.
But, Mike, somebody's yelling at the radio right now and say, okay, come on, Mike, you know that the reason you're all getting rid of them is because they were a pain in the you-know-where.
I think ESPN is doing it for economic reasons. They're going through a complete rebuilding. I mean, their whole business model is changing and they're struggling. They've laid a lot of people off. So it is economic. It's expensive. And I don't know if you know it, but the for-profit news media is going through some realignment and have to do a lot more with a lot less.
I don't know. Dr. Brown brought up the fact that the New York Times and the Washington Post are doing so well by having all these additional people coming online.
Well, it's a different territory than it was. So looking for ways to save money is not unreasonable if you can turn
that. Okay, that's part of it. The other thing is, who are these people? I've interviewed many of them here on public radio, and I can tell
public
you.
Public editors?
Yeah, they're terrific. Mm-hmm. Some of these people are the brightest people in the world. But sometimes they make a mistake. Somebody hires a guy who is what, quote, no reference to you here, Galen, but who's a, quote, professor of journalism and who has nothing to do but sit around and look at the walls and make stuff up. I've seen it happen. And, you know.
Public editors make stuff up. You're asserting that right now.
You bet.
You bet. We'll put a link to that.
I can't tell my name.
Margaret Sullivan was the editor of the Buffalo News for years. She's a,
I agree with you. I agree with you.
Who visited here in Albany and spoke at a class at University of Albany not too long ago. Public editors have been wonderful for the news industry.
You didn't hear me attacking all public editors. In fact, I came on and said I've interviewed many of them and they're terrific. I also know of a few here and there, rather not get sued, who really are, you know, not up to the standard.
Right, but the question here is whether social media like Twitter and Facebook and other public comments can fill that gap somewhat. It does keep the media in check. If a major story breaks and somebody gets it wrong, CNN gets it wrong, or CBS gets it wrong, and people start tweeting, oh, no, that's not true, and they link to counter, that quickly corrects it and puts it back in course. Yeah. The public editor would write a column a week later that said, well, we got it wrong last week. And that's nice, but getting the quick pounce from social media and the public is very effective in keeping you on track and keeping you honest.
You know, NPR has a guy, Folkenflik, who's terrific.
Yeah.
That's his beat. He does it, and he does it so well.
He does it quickly, too. He has it that morning. When the story in the media breaks, he's there that morning. He's not doing it a week later. So that's the value of having pounce kind of a thing.
Judy, you have a suspicious look at your eyes.
I do agree with you, Alan, that the public editors can be kind of a burr in the side of the newspaper in general because they're pointing out things that they do wrong. But I've always respected our profession that they've endured that. You know, that I'm sure that the top editors don't enjoy those.
What do you mean they've endured it? They're not here anymore. They're all gone.
they don't enjoy some of those columns where Margaret Sullivan is saying, hey, we did this wrong. We got this wrong. But it has served to fortify the profession in general. And I'm sad to see it go because there is no one who is more articulate about journalism and ethics and what we do wrong and what we do right than some of the public editor columns I've read.
Yeah, but you still do have commentators. And Margaret Sullivan went on to the Washington Post where she writes frequently about the news media and what they do right and what they do wrong.
Very well.
About all the media, not just the paper where she works. So that's good, too.
I feel like Okrent was the first public editor at the New York Times.
Right.
I remember he wrote a book about his experience being the public editor for the first time. And Judy, you're right. He took a lot of heat from his fellow editors.
Didn't he write a book on baseball also?
Perhaps.
We'll check that out as well.
'Tis the season.
We just have a minute left, but before we head out the door, can we talk a little bit about the gambling decision by the Supreme Court and what it will mean to the media? Are we going to see a boom in advertising, a boom?
Well, let's face it, Judy. Who's fooling who? The news media for years has been putting how many people attended Yankee game.
The America's
night,
line was
last,
always on the little night, tiny
page.
Type.
And that, of course, became the number for the day. And a lot of people knew it. So there's a certain amount of hypocrisy here.
But I think people are places like ESPN, which Mike was referencing earlier. I think they stand to benefit from this decision. And all the other sports news sites are expecting, I think, that they are going to make a lot more money and get a lot more attention.
Yeah, I'm personally sad about it. I think it has the potential to really interfere with college sports, you know.
But, well, you have to say Pete Rose and you understand what the issue is.
Exactly.
Well, there you have it. We've done another media project, this time without the esteemed Rex Smith. But for Judy Patrick, Alan Shartok, Kaylin Brown, and Mike Spain, thank you for listening to us.
They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people.
It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.